Pri šonkliranju ja, je lahko zelo nevarno, ker ti lahko uč padeš obce.
Jutranji padec. Podaja v cirkusu in vsem ostalem, kar lahko razbije studijsko opremo.
Drago cirkuštvo, poslušate oddajo Jutranji padec. Oddajo o cirkusu in vsem drugem, kar lahko razbije studijsko opremo. V današnji oddaji bomo zavrteli drugi del pogovora z Emilom, žonglerjem in priseljencem iz Amerike, ki ga je pot med drugim zanesla tudi na cirkuške srede. V prvem delu pogovora, ki je bil v tej oddaji na sporedu 5. junija lani, smo izvedeli, kako je Emil, ki je odraščal v zvezdni državi Maine, v Združenih državah Amerike, pri 13 letih z velikim olajšanjem pustil šolo ter se pridružil skupini gledališčnikov in cirkusantk. Svoje veščine je tako razvil, da je imel med 16. in 20. letom uspešno kariero kot performer, ki meče stvari v zrak in jih lovi. Pogovor je tekel v začetkih in v koncih nastopanja, optimalni uri za žongliranje, najljubšem nastopu v ZDA, pakiranju rekvizitov ali, kot bi rekli veliki T. Cascadus, school is important, but juggling is importanter. Danes pa vam bomo v šesa spustili drugi del pogovora, v katerem se vrtimo okoli Emilove selitve v Evropo. Hitrega odraščanja, spremembe karierne poti, razlogov za nastopanje in proti njemu, pomembnosti dobrega in posledic slabega cirkuškega managementa, ter usput poskušamo odgovoriti na million dollar question, ali je izključno odlična žonglerska tehnika dovolj za odrsko uprizoritev. Pravi mate. Intervjuju sledi še pisan in rejen cirkuški novičnik, zato ostanite z nami ter našpičite ušesa ob radijskem sprejemniku.
There is the bar is open. Do you want would you like to have some coffee or tea?
Sure, yeah, I'd love to have a coffee.
Yeah? Okay, yeah. Let's go. Where were we? We were you packing the bags. And just going for Europe.
Yeah.
With a contract or just like out of
nope.
the blue?
Nope, I just needed to leave the States again. Just didn't enjoy being there. And I had been doing some work, even during university. I had stopped performing at this point, but halfway through university, I started doing the work that I was being trained to do at university and ended up missing most of my last year of uni because I was traveling for the work. I was doing product design mostly for toy companies. My first product and game design work was as a consultant for Duncan Toys, which is the largest manufacturer of yo-yos in the world. And they also do juggling equipment, and they designed a series of games that were based on sort of physical skill that had like marble and card game combinations. And they had invented all of these games, but no one had tested them before they got created. And then when they got the first prints from the manufacturer and they tried to play the game, they couldn't because the rules didn't work and none of the things made sense. So I got hired to recreate the whole game. I think they thought I was much older than I was, because I was 19, 20, and I was still halfway through university, and I got introduced to them through a contact at the university, but they didn't know I was a student. Yeah, I got to travel around a lot of the U.S. I got to go back and forth from Europe and China a few times,
And you took your juggling equipment with you?
Whenever I could, yeah.
When you left the States
for Europe? Oh, for sure.
For sure.
Yeah.
What
it was one of the
have?
Few things in the bag. Yeah. My climbing gear, my juggling equipment, and some clothes, and a computer. And that was basically the whole bag.
So what was your juggling gear then? Do you remember what you had?
At the time, I had 5 bright green unibody clubs, plastic unibody clubs, air flights, I think they were called. Brutal on the hands if you weren't used to them. Rock hard clubs. But one color, one solid color, no wrappings, no nothing, so super durable. And what was I juggling for balls at the time? Don't remember. It was either a smattering of like destroyed beanbags from various sources.
Are you a fan of sewing beanbags? Would you fix them if they get broken or not?
No, because usually by the time they broke, the fabric itself was so destroyed that it was just time. Every time I put them in the bag, they would leave green bits all over my bag from the fabric. So eventually those had to get rid of.
Do you get sentimental towards your juggling objects? Like, was it difficult to leave something behind or?
It's funny because back then, maybe I would have. I'm not a materialistic person. When my partner and I traveled for 6 straight years, we had 17 kilos each and that was it. We got rid of everything else and I had no problem with that. That was totally fine. I was ready to get rid of everything and I got rid of everything. I think I was a bit more precious about things in general because everything at that point, you know, I dropped out of school when I was 13. I started a career. I moved into my own place when I was 16. For various reasons in my life, I've always felt like I've had to be an adult as quickly as possible. I didn't really have a childhood, you know, I didn't get to be a teenager. That was not part of how I grew up. So, in my early 20s, everything that I had was mine. It wasn't from my parents, it wasn't from people around, it was stuff that I had figured out how to have as my own stuff. So I was, in my early 20s, I was very defensive of the things that were mine and I wanted to hold on to, very much so. So I think at the juggling stuff of that time in my life, I was very precious about. I would literally keep it until it was falling to bits. Okay. And even kept a bag of spare juggling equipment. I think when I left for Europe, I think I left in my mother's house a big duffel of various juggling equipment that I went back and got later and then donated to various circus schools in Europe or in Germany at the time.
So you came to Europe as somebody with a lot of knowledge in theater and performing knowledge and quite probably a very good juggling. And was it, so you went to find work in juggling or you were more open to what you were?
No, at that point, you know, I'm 21 at this point in the story, and I've kind of decided that juggling now is more of a hobby. My professional life is more of something else.
How old are you now? I'm sorry.
21.
But yes, but now. Today.
Oh, now? Yeah. 36.
Okay.
But my community and my friends were all juggling. You know, the second I left Europe, I moved. Well, briefly to Poland again, but mostly to Germany and to Berlin, which is a massive circus hub, you know, filled with all of the best jugglers in the world at various points in recent history. And, you know, to your point, it's hard in Slovenia, but it's hard everywhere in the world except Germany and France. It's easy there. Well, it's not even easy there. It's possible there. And it's not really possible anywhere else anymore. And hasn't been for a while. Sweden, maybe, if you're really good and you really know what you're doing. But, you know, that's mostly because of the Stockholm Circus School and Jay Gilligan and how they run that whole program. So I went from kind of one extreme to another where it was like, theater was something I thought I knew a lot about, but I saw as something really hard. and full of skills that I no longer, or required skills that I no longer wanted. Part of why I moved into so much business stuff in my university education was because one of the things I saw of all of my friends, even the very experienced long-term professionals, was that they all still struggled with money and finance and getting enough work and all these things. And I was just like, that's all right.
So unprofessional.
It's okay. And I didn't want to be in that situation. I certainly didn't want to fight against the things I knew I wasn't good at, rehearsing, the creativity side, the acting side. I didn't want to fight those to then also have to fight to survive financially.
What makes it so difficult in rehearsing?
I just got bored of doing the same things over and over again. I just wasn't good at that. The excitement for me became more and more juggling as opposed to other types of theater. And the excitement of juggling was achieving and discovering new and new things all the time. And so I would create a 5-minute juggling routine just to have something technical that I could show. Mm-hmm. Very kind of boring, dry, but you know, 20 years ago it was still okay to just get up on stage and do some juggling tricks and, you know, mug a performance. Doesn't work so well now. Didn't work great then either, but it's harder now. But I would just, you know, I would do that and I would rehearse it for a week or two and I would get it kind of solid, and then I would go back to practicing my normal juggling and I would learn 4 more tricks and I'd be like, oh, how do I get those tricks into that routine? And as a result, the routine was just always in a state of not good, because you're always trying to find an excuse to show off the new thing that you figured out how to do, but none of that is very stable. And so it became sort of a burden of, I don't like rehearsing all the time, and then when I do a show, because I'm trying to always add and change it, it's never very good, you know, or I drop a lot or whatever, and that's no fun. And like, it stopped being fun for that reason. I just couldn't find a middle ground where I was spending the time doing the work in a way that I enjoyed and performing something I enjoyed.
You mentioned the drop.
Yeah.
Drop is kind of a big thing in juggling. Is it or isn't for you?
It really depends on what you're doing. Mm-hmm. If you're up there to juggle and do a fairly technical routine that is visually driven or conceptually driven by throws and catches, dropping is a big effing deal.
What was your strategy? What kind of relation did you develop as a stage performer?
I think you get to the point where you have to read where you are, because it also depends on if your routine is really timed, you know? So if your routine is really tightly timed, the advantage of rehearsing a lot is that you know that if you drop, you either have time to sort of do something around the drop,
mm-hmm.
or you have to pick it up and just put it right back into the pattern somehow as quickly as possible, as if nothing happened.
Mm-hmm.
And then, of course, there's like, you know, the big trick drop, which is sort of, you almost do that intentionally, right? Like if you're finishing on a big trick in a technical performance,
mm-hmm.
you know, you sort of give lots of time and space and you sort of try and get the audience behind the fact that this is going to be really hard. And then if you drop, that's almost part of an illustration of how hard it really is, as long as you can still actually do the trick.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I mm-hmm. think at the time that I was a performer, I thought that was a valid way to approach that. I think now that's the laziest thing a juggler can do. And I really dislike the fact that I used to perform that way.
What is the laziest thing a juggler can do?
To do a technical performance that leads to a big trick and to kind of allow that big trick so much space that it's okay to drop
it. That you put too much time on the finale.
Yeah, like, well, okay. And you put so much emphasis on something that really, in the end, isn't what the audience is there for. Because 99% of the time, the audience will say, oh, it's big. But they don't know how many you're doing. They don't know the separation of objects and the importance of that. They can't comprehend the difference between 5 and 7 objects or 4 and 6 objects. So it's irrelevant. Unless you're doing it for a juggling audience and you're just trying to show off, which is, you know, it's fine. That's what open stages at conventions are for. That's, you know, or renegade shows. That's fine. But I realized kind of a little bit in that period, but definitely later as well in life, that like, that's just not a, it's a place to start as a performer. If you're juggling and you need to figure out how to put something on stage, it's a place where you start. But if you're going to really dedicate yourself to being any sort of juggling performer, you need to think way beyond the juggling.
Mm-hmm.
The juggling is just a tool. Mm-hmm. It's just a part of the process, but it shouldn't be the only thing there.
Mm-hmm.
And I've had very long, protracted arguments with a lot of artists,
mm-hmm.
including artists who are far better artists and better educated and know way more and are far more successful performers than I am. We've had long, protracted conversations about the validity of whether or not juggling, in its technical purity, can itself exist on stage
mm-hmm.
and be valid.
That's a million-dollar question, I would say.
Yeah.
Because as a show of an abstraction, if we say juggling can be, then it's quite valid to show the possibilities of time and space and separation, everything that you mentioned. But at the same time, it gets boring, and this is such a strange thing that happens, you know, because also if you see an abstract painting or something, you can either watch it forever or you just glimpse over and just an impression stays. I don't know.
I think juggling sight swaps for 7 minutes doesn't do that, even if you do it perfectly. And that's the argument that always comes, right? There's some very renowned and amazingly accomplished jugglers in the world whose performance is standing on stage in a costume, maybe, and doing 7 minutes of the most perfect, flawless, uninterrupted technical juggling. Mm-hmm. And they never drop, ever. And they do things that would take me 3 years to figure out how to do, mm-hmm. right? Is that itself a valid performance? It's the highest level of technical achievement that you could ever see on a stage. So does it prove its own point, or is it completely lacking any essence because it's not actually making any sort of...
It depends who you ask. If you ask a juggler, then it's completely valid and it's a pleasure to watch. So I think we spoke about side swaps in some previous emissions of the show, but just shortly, for the public, for the listeners, side swap is a way of notation of juggling patterns. And if we say it really briefly, if you can write music with notes, then you can write juggling patterns in numbers. But just the difference is that in numbers, in sideswap, you cannot, as in music, you cannot write down the tempo or the way you do the pattern, but it's just a...
It's based on the concept of a universal rhythm. So every number is exactly the same rhythm regardless of the number and placement of the pattern. And that's why mathematically it then works.
And is there a sideswap that you really like to watch and the sideswap that you really like to juggle?
As I think sideswaps that are the most beautiful, if you will, and in my opinion, kind of the only notated patterns that you can really justify performing as well, are ones that stack objects in air. So whether that be multiplexes or asynchronous stack patterns like 531, 7531, 97531, B's 97531, DB 97531, et cetera, et cetera. These, and then, multiplex stacks, usually with four and above objects.
What was then the breaking point, since you said you will stop with performance, and then you came to Europe and you kind of restarted, no?
Kind of. You know, I was living very much in the juggling community when I moved back to Europe, particularly in Germany. I was going to a lot of conventions, you know, and I got into it in a different way. I was, you know, playing a lot of games at conventions. You know, I was getting into final placements at EJC Volley Club and in the last two or three at, you know, big fight night events and for club combat and stuff. And, you know, I was good at it still. I was still, an active player, and that was a lot of fun. but I wasn't really performing. But I still kind of had like a chip on my shoulder, right? Like I had a kind of an ego about it because I've been doing it for so long. I knew so much. I could look at a piece and I could deconstruct it immediately. And like, what if we tried this? You know, like I had all these things that I still wanted to contribute, which mostly just came out as, you know, being a 20-year-old arrogant prick for the most part. But like, then I had some big performing opportunities, mostly one tour, one big summer-long tour that I did with... The only reason I said yes to it really was because two of the other jugglers on the tour are two people that I have respected and admired as jugglers for long before I knew them personally, who are Benjamin Richter and Luke Wilson, who has unfortunately passed. I don't think I'd ever met Luke face to face before the tour, but I'd met Ben once or twice. And I was so excited about the idea of maybe possibly getting to work with them that I said yes to this tour 3 months before it happened without having created or rehearsed a single thing in terms of material for like 4 years. And I just worked my ass off for 3 months to try and get something together and then went on this big tour across different venues, mostly large family campsites, but different venues along the northern German coast and then the southern Sweden coast.
Is there something that you would like to shout out to the circus managers?
I think there's two problems with a lot of people who work in the business or organizational side of circus, which is they've fallen into the role kind of by accident of being the best organized of the people around them, but that doesn't mean they're well organized. And that doesn't mean they know anything about business. And whether you're doing it for free as a nonprofit concept or organization, or you're doing it for money as a performer and a group, success lives off of being good at the non-circus part. You have to be good at the business side. You have to be good at the organizational side. And even more poignantly, you have to be able to do the organizational and administrative side without being stressed out about it. Because if that stresses you out, then doing more of it or doing it at scale is just never going to be something that you enjoy or are ever going to be particularly good at. And I think one of my biggest problems with, it's a natural sort of byproduct of what the industry is, but one of my pet peeves with the industry is that so much of it is so badly organized. And as a result, the artistic nature of circus performance has been lost and pushed away and sort of no longer given value in a lot of the world because that industry has completely failed to stand up for itself in every way. They have, like many people in the fine arts world, they have expected the art of it to stand up as the argument for why it should exist. And unfortunately, that's just not really how the world works, whether we like it or not. So I really urge people to like embrace what they're good at and find, if you want to work on the organizational side of circus, put the time and give your patience to being good and practicing the skills that take to organize those things well. And it will serve dividends to you and the people around you because A, you'll enjoy it more if you know what you're doing and it's easier. And you'll be able to do more for yourself and your colleagues in terms of getting them on stages or in front of audiences. And that's, you know, unless you just want to do it as a hobby, that's ultimately the point, right? And if we're talking about the difference between being a hobbyist or an amateur or a professional, I would still say that even I fall more historically into the amateur thing. I can never claim to have been performing full-time as my only income source. I came close off and on here and there, but it was never solely my only income source. So I fall much more into the amateurish category. I know very few people who have successfully and long term been professional performers. And the ones who have done that and are also financially safe and comfortable with the work after many years of doing it are the ones who are good at the business side. They're good at the organization side.
So now we have been talking for an hour.
Guten Tag.
And maybe it's time that we slowly wrap it up. So the final, let's say the pre-final question would be, is there a juggling pickup line you would like to share with us?
Juggling pickup line. You sent me this question beforehand, which is good because I had to really think hard about it. And now I have to even think to remember what the one that I remembered was. And I think it was at, I think I heard this drunken in the convention tent in Berlin 14 years ago, which was something along the lines of, do you juggle with fire sometimes?
Yeah.
You must be good at it because you've lit a fire in me.
Okay.
And there's a, depending on how you answer, there's a much dirtier version of my response and a much cleaner version. So it depends on how you answer. And the yes version, I think, is the dirty one. And the dirty one is something like, well, you can juggle my torch anytime. Something like that. Another great question that you asked me was, what pattern would I use to destroy as much equipment as possible in a sound studio?
Thank you.
Seven Please. Club Ultimates would for sure be up there. And so Seven Club Ultimates is something that's just achievable for quite a lot of, you know, you have to be a strong juggler, but you don't have to be an extremely technical juggler to do it. But when all the clubs collide in an accident in the middle of the pattern, they explode in all directions and it creates absolute chaos. And I've definitely hurt myself and other people juggling that pattern, both on and off stage.
Okay, so now we know which pattern jugglers will use in the changing of the world around them.
Exactly, exactly.
So Emil, thank you very much.
My pleasure.
For taking your time for the radio student interview. And we wish you good luck
thank
in what you.
You
do.
Thank you very much for having me. It was a pleasure.
Oh, let me out.
Izobraževanje o fizičnem gledališču. Globus Hystericus mojstri fizičnega gledališča bodo marca in aprila izvedli 66-urno izobraževanje s poudarkom na fizičnih vidikih gledališke igre. Osrednji fokus usposabljanja, navdihnjenega s pedagoško dediščino Žaka Lekoka, sta človeško telo in njegov odnos do prostora. Program bo izostril zavedanje o vašem performativnem telesu, izboljšala se bo možnost za odpravljanje starih navad in odkrivanje novih načinov izražanja ter igre. Za več informacij in prijavo, ki je že odprta, in sicer do zapolnitve mest, počekirajte spletno stran Globus Hystericus. Monoklovo vabilo na kabare. V sklopu lezbičnega bara se v Monoklu premierno obeta cirkuško obarvan kabaretni večer. Če imate kaj pokazati ali bi si želeli biti del tega, pišite in se javite Monoklu. Kabare bo 20. februarja zvečer, če niste nastopajoče razpoložene, pa brez zadržkov obiščite mešano kabaretno malho in se naužite cirkuštva in vsega onkraj kot gledalke. Cirkuška rezidencialna mreža 2025, poziv k prijavam. Če se ukvarjaš s sodobnim cirkusom in si želiš izpiliti material, ti priporočamo, da se do 14. februarja prijaviš na rezidenco. Kriti ti bodo potni stroški in nastanitev, imela boš dostop do prostora za vaje in možnost organizacije predstavitve Work in Progress, ter še kaj, izbiraš pa lahko med kopico zanimivih vadbenih prostorov po Balkanu. Najbolje bo, da več informacij prebereš na spletni strani Cirkus kolektiva ali na povezavi pod tem člankom na spletni strani Radija Študent. Zagreb. Kino Cirkus. V sklopu Kina Cirkus se bo 6. februarja v Zagrebu v Mo Donja Kustošija brezplačno predvajal igrani cirkuški film The Magnet Man. Družinska predstava Deklica in slon. Za 5 evrov na osebo si v cirkuški dvorani cirkusa Fuskabo lahko ogledate predstavo Deklica in slon, ki je nastala v koprodukciji zavoda Bufeto in Darke Erdelji. Gre za zgodbo o deklici, ki s pomočjo domišljije in najbližjih premaga otožnost in strahove. Metelkovska turneja reprezentance keglovih vaj. Reprezentanca keglovih vaj vas vabi, da jo ujamete na februarski metelkovski turneji. Kegli bodo v zraku na antivalentinovskem benefitu v galeriji Alcatraz 14. februarja, v Monoklu 20. februarja in 25. februarja na Ignoru v Channelu Zero. Cirkuška sreda, igrce za vedno. Danes na cirkuško sredo se bo zopet igralo po cirkuško. Po uvodni uri bo kot običajno prosta vaja do 8. ure. Na pedagoški fakulteti v telovadnici številka 3 lahko že kaj znaš, lahko pa nič. Udeležba je brezplačna. Oddajo sta pripravili Eva Z in Emo K. Govoril je Čeh, tehnicirala pa je Selila.
Okupacija, kalkulacija, segregacija, imigracija, konspiracija.
Kako dolgo pa se dejansko pripravljajo na eno točko?
V bistvu koliko? 10 minut?
Ne.
Ne, včasih več.
Ne. Samo zaradi njegove rame nam ni uspelo.
Ja, nima uspel še te točke.
Tako da smo gotovili, da v bistvu ni zdravo. Da
ja, boljše je pol tam eno uro prej pripraviti.
Ker pol veš, da v eni uri je veliko manjša verjetnost, da se kakšna rama spahne.